You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SCR in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name's Anthony Dockwell, sitting in for Nina Capel this week. Barnaby Joyce wants to be left alone, but for $150,000, Channel 7 has been invited into the family home. Should we be worried about this kind of checkbook journalism? Also, Facebook is in the poo again, this time for censoring the Cancer Council. Roseanne Barr has had her show axed after a racist outburst on Twitter. And finally, the ABC in Fairfax broke the story on Don Burke and his years of harassment, but Channel 9 and Our Current Affair have the nod from the Logies. Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues, we have BuzzFeed's breaking news reporter, Jenna Rushton. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Watkins, media reporter for Crikey. Hello, Emily.
Hi.
And joining us on the line, we have Michael Owen, who is the Adelaide Bureau Chief for The Australian. Welcome, Michael.
G'day, how are you?
On the weekend, news broke that Australia's most successful retail politician, Barnaby Joyce, and his partner, Vicky Campion, will be talking to Channel 7's Sunday night program, and all for the tune of $150,000. Now, the money is reported to be going into a trust account for their six-week-old baby, Sebastian, but this hasn't stopped news of the payment from causing a storm across the country. The fallout has been so strong, Barnaby Joyce has now taken extended personal leave until August. It should be said that checkbook journalism is nothing new, but maybe it is when we're talking about a sitting politician. First up, can I gauge the feelings of the panel here? Is anyone angry that a former Deputy Prime Minister and the current member of the seat of New England is involved in a $150,000 payment for an interview? Let's start with you, Gina.
I wouldn't say I'm angry about it, but I think it's interesting that he is willing to profit from one type of journalism, checkbook journalism, and at the same time has come out and said that there needs to be, you know, privacy taught and kind of attacked, what would impede on another type of journalism, which really does hold power to account. This idea that that he wants a kind of world where we wouldn't be able to do doorstops or take photos or whatever. I just think it's interesting he's willing to profit on one type of journalism and attack another.
Emily?
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm not sure if angry is the right word, but I think it's a really bad look. I'd agree with Gina. I think especially when he's talking about restricting the press in another way, when he's also, keen to profit from it if he can. When he's paid to be held to account by his electorate and by the press. So I think it's really off.
Michael, do you share those views?
Yeah, look, I think with Barnaby Joyce, I mean, he's a politician, and this is a narcissism at the highest level. He on the one hand, he says he wants his privacy restricted, but then he just can't shut up, and he can't help himself but continue to do interviews and to almost seek the limelight while trying to say that he's avoiding it. And I think the whole thing's a bit crass, and it could have been handled a lot better. A different politician, a different person may well have just kind of put out a statement and left it at that. This is a private matter. There's my statement. And, every time he's asked a question, refer journalists to that statement. But, I think also what people should be more angry about, I reckon, is the way that Barnaby's continually dumped his partner in it. It was seen in blame. I think it's not the first time that he's shunted responsibility onto Miss Campion. He says that this deal was all of her doing, nothing to do with him. It strikes me that he hasn't really got his partners back.
Now, look, every transaction has two parties. Has Channel 7 erred here by paying for an interview? Emily?
Look, I'm probably pretty liberal when it comes to these things. I think if Channel 7 thinks that they can make ratings out of it, they can make money out of it, and they think it's worth it, they're a business, and I don't particularly have a problem with them paying for it. But, I think it's more on Barnaby Joyce and Vicky Campion accepting that money more than anything.
Does anyone have a problem with Channel 7 paying for this? I mean, there was no shortage of media outlets willing to give Barnaby and his family a platform.
Yeah, I think there's obviously a market for it, and clearly, we'll probably all be watching it. I'm sure a lot of people will be watching it and be interested in what's going on. At the end of the day, yeah, look, if there was no interest, there would be no payment, and Barnaby Joyce and Vicky Campion are completely entitled to give the interview for free, but they obviously have shopped it around and gone to the highest bidder.
Now I'm guessing all of us here at some stage when we've been requesting an interview, been asked whether there was a payment involved. Even here in community radio, it happens. How does the panel feel about checkbook journalism, though? Do you see it as a legitimate form of journalism?
I'm not sure if legitimate is the right word. I mean, I think it sits a lot better with most people when it's someone who, for example, the Beaconsfield Miners or Stuart Diver, or someone who's been through a natural disaster or has been the victim of a crime or something like that, that's going to rate really well and that the network will make money off. I think that sits a little bit better with people when you know that they're also profiting off something, out of something terrible that they've gone through. I think when it's a criminal or someone, you know, like Chappelle Corby's family, for example, or those sorts of situations, I think that that maybe is a little less black and white as to whether there should be payment for it. But I think it just all comes back to the fact that they're, you know, it's commercial TV networks for the most part, or the magazines paying for it, and their businesses. And if there's a market, then I guess they'll pay if they see value in it.
Gina, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I completely agree. And just thinking of one instance where I tried to interview someone and they said ultimately that they were being paid for an interview, and it was a case in which they had been a victim. And I just remember thinking, fair enough.
Mm. Yeah, look, it's very frustrating for news journalists, or for any journalist really. You want to cover a story the best you can. You want to speak to all the people involved and get the facts. And you can't do that if key people involved in that story refuse to speak to you because they've done some exclusive deal with another outlet. And, you know, look, it happens. It's the reality. It's, you know, there's commercial interests out there. I think, you know, in some cases, the one that springs to mind is the two backpackers, the one from the Brazilian and the German girl who were attacked by that crazy guy on the beach in the Coorong. They did a paid interview, I think, with one of the networks, and I don't think anyone would hold that against them for doing that interview after the fact, because it was such a traumatic experience for them, and I suppose they felt that you know, they could control the story a bit better if they were talking about it, and if they can you know, have some money towards their futures after what they went through, you know, perhaps that's fitting as well.
Okay, well, it seems the general consensus is that there are times and places for checkbook journalism, but let's bring it back to the coalface of our democracy. You know, Barnaby Joyce has said that he's not receiving any payment here. It's going into a trust account for his child. But does anybody here see long-term implications if money is going to family members of politicians?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not a great precedent, but I think it's quite unusual. I mean, I'd like to think these circumstances aren't something that happen that regularly. I mean, in recent history, I can't imagine a story. I can't remember a story quite like this, I should say. So, I mean, hopefully it's an exception with the, you know, circumstances, the personalities involved. Hopefully it's not a precedent. I think, you know, it's a bit clever to be saying we don't benefit because it's going into a trust for our son, because that's still money that their son will be getting that they won't have to fork out, whether it's for school fees or university or, you know, something like that.
Michael, how do you feel?
Look, I think it's a bit crass, as I said earlier. I think that end of the day, you know, on one hand, you can understand at a very base level why they accepted the money. You know, like Vicky Campion's a former journalist and a press secretary who probably hasn't got much hope of going back into a press secretary role. So, you know, she would be, I suppose, aware of the financial aspects that could be made out of such a story, and to, you know, to strike while the iron's hot, while there's interest, you need to move quickly on these things before interest wanes. And, you know, but Barnaby Joyce, he's not a poor man. He's earned more than $3 million during his political career. He's going to have a pretty healthy superannuation scheme when he finally quits politics. I don't think you can kind of say in this case that they're crying poor. And I think, you know, out of all this, no one's really thought about the child. I mean, end of the day, you know, this child has no say over what's happening. And also, you know, Barnaby's family, you know, this is not his only family. The whole thing, you know, is not an edifying spectacle for his own family. Imagine being his daughter or his ex-wife having to watch this on national television. I think it's a pretty selfish act, I would say, by both Barnaby and Vicky Camping.
Now, Gina touched on this earlier, that Barnaby's called for tort of invasion of privacy. And the logic being, if there is logic in all of this, if it was illegal for the Daily Telegraph to cover his private life, there would be no story to sell. Mm. Now, you know, the idea of protecting privacy in common law is best a thought bubble at this stage. But, you know, from little things, big things grow. How worried should we be about the idea of privacy and journalism, you know, operating together at the same time?
We should be very concerned when politicians try to restrict the actions of the media and cloak it in something about privacy, because these laws can be manipulated to ensure that other aspects of a politician's private life that may impact upon his public life are not covered under the, you know, by the media if these things come into effect. So I think any time a politician tries to restrict the rights of the media to report, alarm bells should ring pretty loudly, I would say.
Yeah, I think especially as well when it's tied in very specifically by Barnaby Joyce in this circumstance to his own situation. You know, I mean, it's sort of been recommended from time to time over the years by the Law Reform Commission and various reports that there be a statutory privacy right written into our law, but neither of the major parties have ever really shown any interest in making that happen in the past. So, you know, it's waiting until his own privacy is invaded to suggest that it's time to change the law is probably not quite right. I wouldn't have thought.
I would love someone to ask Barnaby if he thought that the tort of privacy should apply to, or should have applied to, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard with their two dogs, because he was pretty happy to drag them publicly.
Look, I mean, he's brought up that, you know, his house was buzzed by drones and harassed by paparazzi. Mm. I mean, does he have any point here? Or is he over-egging the dishes?
I don't think he really has a leg to stand on, to be honest.
No, look, I mean, Australia does have notoriously weak privacy laws, but, I mean, in that we don't have any statutory right to privacy. But, I mean, I imagine even if we did have a tort of privacy that there would be some sort of, or I would hope that there'd be some sort of public interest defence written into that, in which case the Daily Telegraph, as it has been all along, would be, when it first revealed this story, that it was in the public interest, and there have been legitimate questions that have been raised about the relationship and how it related to his office and his work. So, I mean, I'm not sure that it necessarily would have stopped the story coming out anyway.
And just in regards to the drones, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I would have thought, I don't think it's actually illegal to put drones over people's houses or in their backyards or so forth. There are restrictions around the use of drones and that type of thing. So, and there are still privacy laws in place and basic laws on trespass and other things such as that. So, you know, if Barnaby's got a problem, perhaps he should go to the police and, you know, let them handle it rather than trying to change the law in a way that makes it look as if he's trying to protect himself.
You're listening to Fourth Estate. I'm Anthony Dockrell. This week we're talking to Emily Watkins, media reporter for Crikey, BuzzFeed's breaking news reporter Gina Rushton, and Michael Owen, who's the Adelaide Bureau Chief for The Australian. Just when you thought Facebook couldn't go any lower, they are now stopping us Australians from talking about our poo and our wee. The Cancer Council has had a series of ads banned on Facebook, all because they want us to get a checkup, and also look at our poo and our wee. The ads are designed to raise awareness, but also break down the barriers of shame that stop people from looking and talking about their bodily waste. The Cancer Council has tried a number of times to make the ads fit Facebook's rules, but all to no avail. The sticking point for the ads is to do with Facebook's viewing these ads as referring to people's personal attributes, which under its guidelines is not allowed. Now, I'm sure all three news organisations that you represent would reserve the right to reject any advertising that fails to meet their standards. But Emily, can you make sense of this move from Facebook?
I guess I can see both sides of it. I mean, I understand, obviously, that Facebook has its rules around what advertising it will accept, especially when it's targeted in the way that it is. So I guess I can see where they're coming from. But I think it just shows that when you have really rigid rules at a really big organisation like Facebook, and like the Cancer Council has said, you know, this is our only way of targeting a lot of people, and it's a very effective way of targeting people, I can see why they're upset. And I don't know, maybe if there was a little more of a human touch at Facebook that could maybe look through and make a common sense call on this, that probably would have made sense in this instance.
Gina, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think like it just as a, I think the everyday person would kind of read that and just think, what the hell? Like, you know, you think about the stuff that's allowed on Facebook and within Facebook groups. I understand this is advertising, but like, you know, I just think of the Clive Palmer meme page and the amount of like anti-Semitism and racism, and just there's just so much stuff on Facebook that is so deeply offensive. I just think it's crazy, to be honest.
So, look, you know, they're two sports that unite the world, soccer and bashing Facebook. is Facebook in a no-win situation here? If they let these ads go through, will they be letting less well-meaning ads come through?
Yeah, I think it's kind of one of those funny things where it's almost like you're dealing with some kind of computer algorithm and you can't actually make any common sense argument to a real person. I just wonder, I'm just unclear as to whether or not someone from the Cancer Council actually could sit down and have a phone conversation with somebody from Facebook, or whether it was just some guy in Silicon Valley and going through the rules and going, well, actually, no, we can reject it on this basis. So, I think sometimes that's a problem with these, with something that becomes so big and so huge that the common sense goes out the window because decisions are being made by people that are following some kind of strict rule book. There's not a lot of leeway or compromise there. So, it's a funny story. I'm sure there's ways of getting around it. Perhaps by getting people to post things and tag them in. But as far as an official campaign goes, it looks like the Cancer Council are going to have to think of a different way around it, or perhaps make some kind of direct contact with the people that run Facebook, if that's possible. And it's pretty hard to do sometimes.
Gina, is the problem here just that Facebook is too big, it's too global, it just is not able to deal with any kind of subtlety or anything to do, which is obviously, you know, it's a local issue here in Australia?
I'm just going to say yes, because I think that all news organisations should drag Facebook. But yeah, no, I think you're right. Yes. Right.
You're listening to The Fourth Estate. Well, Roseanne Barr has just discovered the power of social media, with the American network ABC and Channel 10 here in Australia axing her show in a matter of hours after she posted a racist tweet attacking Barack Obama's advisor, Valerie Jarrett. Roseanne has since apologised, but the damage is done and her show that had returned to high ratings and positive reviews is finished. Gina, was the ABC and Channel 10 correct to act so quickly?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think the thing with Twitter is you can't really hide from it, and I think ultimately it would have been in any of these situations, there would have just been calls for it. And
it's not something that we've actually seen in the past. Normally these kinds of situations are drawn out and it's a very long, torturous, poisonous and painful experience. This happened so quickly.
Yeah, I just think that they probably saw that was the inevitable end and decided to...
Mike, what did you think of the swiftness from the ABC?
Look, I think Roseanne Barr, she has a brand. She's known for vulgar comedy. And I think she probably just misread the mood pretty badly here. I think that, you know, once upon a time, you could get away with this type of stuff, but she's become yet another person, celebrity, and media identity, and any other number of person that's reached for the phone, bashed in those things on Twitter, and realised later it was probably not a good idea. So she's another victim of a stupid tweet.
Look, Roseanne's history on social media didn't stop her getting employed, but ultimately brought it to an end, at least on network TV. What point do you think an employer should explore someone's history, and at what point should they back off, Emily?
Oh, I have no doubt that ABC knew about Roseanne Barr's history. I think they were probably hoping to get some extra ratings out of it. I mean, controversy drives ratings. You know, she was tapping into a mood in the US that, for better or worse, would get either positive or negative responses. I think they knew what they were doing, and I think this was kind of inevitable. And I think part of the reason that they acted so quickly was because she's tweeted very similar things in the past and apologised and then done it again and apologised. And I think this was always gonna happen.
So who sees it's just a case of the ABC wanting fire and unfortunately getting it?
To be fair,
though, I mean, you know, Roseanne Barr hasn't hid who she is. So her show appeals to a certain market, a pretty big market, because when her show debuted, I suppose her rebadged show, it was the best ratings for a comedy since 2014. Mm-hmm. So when those returns were in, ABC instantly renewed her show for a second season. So, I think you can push the boundaries, you can get away with stuff, you can tweet and so forth. But on this occasion, she went too far. She's not the first, and she won't be the last person to do something stupid on Twitter and find themselves in trouble over it.
One of the aspects of this particular situation is not just the hurt that she's caused. Something in the order of about 200 people are now out of a job. You know, there's a very long tail to this particular tweet, if you think about it, and especially if you're one of the people who now doesn't have a job. As a media organisation, what do you think they should be doing to protect themselves and also their staff? I mean, we could just say, hey, don't employ racists, but is there anything they should be doing but they're not doing? Gina?
That's a really hard one, and it is obviously the responsibility of the station. But I think, as Emily said, it was a calculated risk. Like, they know what she was like. They probably knew this was always a risk. So they already had, in a sense, put these people's jobs in the firing line, I think, by hiring her.
Yeah.
But there's no guarantees. I mean, those people could have been out of job after two episodes if the show tanked. I think the people that are working in this environment know exactly the said job security.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a fickle industry, like you said, Michael. It could, if there had been terrible ratings on the first episode, they might have canned it without even finishing the season.
I think they would have canned it without even thinking.
Okay, well, look, finally, eyebrows have been raised in journalistic circles around the country this week, with Channel 9's A Current Affair being nominated for Outstanding News Coverage for their interview of Don Burke. Only problem, they didn't break the story. ABC and Fairfax did. Now, being a journalist can be a thankless task at times, but were the ABC and Fairfax hard done by here? Gina?
I'm generally really wary of journalists who take awards seriously and also journalists who take their work too seriously, but I actually think this was pretty terrible. I think that it seems unfair, it seems odd, and I don't know what the processes are for choosing nominees, but I think that you have to reward original journalism and yarn breakers. And I think that it's also interesting, like the story, you know, the original investigation was about the women and their stories. And I think in a way that this choice shows that we didn't reward that, I guess, as much as this kind of exclusive sit down with
Yep, Don coming back to TV.
With Don. So
now, Jeannie, BuzzFeed recently broke a story about the Commonwealth Bank losing 12 million accounts, and other news organisations, ran with the story. Is it annoying to do the legwork and see others steal your glory?
Yeah, I mean, look, we get it particularly bad. People are particularly embarrassed to attribute BuzzFeed News with our scoops, and that's fine. But it is frustrating, and privately and sometimes publicly on Twitter, you can be petty about it. But it is. Look, of course, it's frustrating. It is.
But look, here's the rub, I guess. Like, as a journalist, you work on a large story. You want other journalists to pick up that story and run with it to keep moving through the news cycle.
Yeah.
Do journalists need just to be like Elsa from Frozen and let it go, Emily?
Maybe. I mean, going back to the Logie example, Kate McClymont, who worked on that story as well for Fairfax, was quite gracious on Twitter and said that Tracy Grimshaw did do a really good job of that interview with Don Burke, which she did. It was an excellent interview, tough interview on him. I think if you take awards too seriously, that's not very becoming, perhaps. But, I mean, I think a lot of journalists as well don't really take the Logies too seriously. I think they probably care more about the Walkleys, which are judged by journalists, and that the ABC's 7:30 piece about Don Burke actually has been shortlisted, I think, for one of the Walkley categories that's just been announced this week. So they're probably pretty happy about that.
And sometimes with exclusivity, it's annoying when it's, like, it's... So, for example, I write about reproductive rights, which no one cares about. So when someone plagiarises my story for a big outlet, which they do often, I kind of think, yeah, more coverage. I don't even care that you've copied and pasted this, because this is an issue that no one's talking about. But when you've got something that's really niche and exclusive and it just changes with whatever the topic is.
Yeah, I don't think people realise how hard and how much sweat goes into some stories with the research, with the going through legal, the back and forth, arguing about a word, and suddenly you put
and
it
the Combank
out there.
One, obviously, there was a lot of legwork, a lot of legal, a lot of risk, and then we weren't really attributed anywhere.
I've learned over the years not to get too hung up on awards. You win some and you lose some, and at the end of the day, it's a bunch of other people making a decision, a very small number of people in some cases, with their own biases and their own views of the world, that are going, well, this entry is better than that entry. I mean, who are these people? a small judging panel. It's certainly not. A popular vote. So I think that at the end of the day, the ABC and Fairfax, they know that they broke the story. Everyone knows they broke the story. And getting back to the point raised earlier, that's supposed to be about the issue and rather than the award. Getting a pat on the back for doing it. I mean, I think the fact that it was such a huge story, it had such ramifications, should be reward enough, to be honest. And, the fact they chose Don Burke to go out with, that was also done quite deliberately to get as much attention as they possibly could to the issue. I think getting hung up over about whether you get a Logie nomination for your story or someone else gets a Logie nomination for following up that story, end of the day, it's all just, journalist ego, really.
That's it from us on A Fourth Estate. Thanks to my guests, Emily Watkins, media reporter for Crikey, BuzzFeed's breaking news reporter Gina Rushton, and Michael Owen, who is the Adelaide Bureau Chief for The Australian. Next week, Peter Frey will be in the host seat. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app, so you can hear us talk media and politics and where the two combine. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is 4thestateAU. My name's Anthony Dockrell. Thanks for listening.